Introducing The Church at Work, a transcribed report of what men and women are planning and accomplishing in our local communities and all over the world, through their churches and in their private lives. This is James V. Anderson speaking, and in this audition tape, I'd like to describe this series and then give you a sample. When you want to do a good job on a program, you use the best trained people available. Network affiliations offer specialists in many fields, but even a local staff does what it can to assign special people to sports events, women's features, local news, farm shows, and weather. Seldom, however, does a radio station have what the newspapers call a religion editor, even though more people go to church than go to ball games. That's the service we offer you. Experienced personnel, wide contacts, specialized professional production, all contributed as a public service by a long-established, highly regarded national church body, the Evangelical Lutheran Church. Basically, the story of the Church at Work is told through carefully edited news of action and accomplishment throughout the world. What is unique, however, is the program's direct presentation of some of the people who are engaged in the work. Instead of an impersonal report, the Church at Work brings you their own words through interviews, excerpts from talks, and specially recorded comments. In the voices of the people who are the news, you learn the reason and the motivation for their actions. Sometimes a few words suffice to tell a story. Other times, most of a program may be devoted to a major event, to a representative institution, or to a gifted personality. What is of chief importance to us is not that 20 news items are used on a program, though that may happen, but that some story becomes more meaningful in the context and perspective of all that is happening. As the name implies, it is the purpose of the program to inform listeners about the Christian Church, but appropriate information about other religious groups is also included. The emphasis is on the constructive influence of the churches in each community and in the lives of people. Many denominations contribute material directly, and the program has been carried on both commercial and educational stations in many parts of the country. Music is part of the story, too, and it is used that way. The color and mood of an event may become very clear in its music, and it gives variety and depth to the Church at Work. The program is fortunate in having Minneapolis as a production home. The Minneapolis-St. Paul area has become an international focal point for church organizations and a crossroads for visiting personalities. In 1953, for example, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the USA was held here. In 1954, the International Anglican Congress. In 1956, the Methodist International General Conference, and in 1957, the Lutheran World Federation assembled here. The whole Upper Midwest has been an area of progressive, imaginative work by many denominations. Beyond that, however, the Church at Work draws material from many parts of the country and from overseas. Occasionally, participating radio stations contribute recorded segments. But now draw your own conclusions from actual broadcasts. You who are program directors or experienced program committee members recognize the value of flexibility in a format. You know, too, that variety can hardly be encompassed in an example or two, so when you hear the samples, please remember the general description, too. First, you'll hear the special program prepared at the end of the year, which is itself a bird's-eye view of the Church at Work. And then you'll hear a more typical program showing how these purposes and techniques work together on one occasion. Presenting The Church at Work. The days that bring us to the end of an old year bring us also to the beginning of another, and we see life continuing in all its fascinating aspects. This is James V. Anderson speaking, and today's transcribed issue of The Church at Work will take a look backward at the events of 1956 that made news in the field of religion. This is the 96th program of this series. As we watch the Church at Work with the Spirit of God and through the lives of men and women, we find adventures in every area of life and in all parts of the world. In the first days of the year, world attention focused on a remote riverbank in South America. Five American Protestant missionaries, slain in the jungles of Ecuador by savage Auca Indians that they had sought to convert, have now been buried on the banks of the Curare River. Five young men were killed, but their example inspired an increased interest in world missions that has encouraged a larger number to take their place. Later in the year, we heard the father of one of the slain missionaries.
I've lived this incident every day since January 13th. God put a stab into my heart as well as he put a spear through those boys.
That is T.E. McCulley of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He spoke also of one of the five young widows created by the incident of January 8, 1956.
Mary Lou McCulley, our daughter-in-law, as you know, has three little boys. One was born after Ed was slain. She intends to go back to Quito to open up a home for missionary children in order that they might go to school at the Christian Missionary Alliance School, which is located on the HCJB compound in Quito, Ecuador.
In February, we went to Shakopee, Minnesota, to see the church at work inside a state reformatory for women. In the laundry, a woman who had accepted Christian counseling was asked whether there would be changes if she could live her life again.
Well, maybe I'll just upset your trend of thought a little bit and say that I'm really glad that I came here, because I think what I thought was independence in the past, not wanting anyone to help me, no doubt, was false pride. And I'm sure that I'm going to be able to face reality and be a much bigger person after leaving here.
In 1956, people questioned whether the apparent spiritual awakening in America is genuine. Clarence Solberg of the Evangelical Lutheran Church gave part of the answer.
There's no question at all in my mind on the score. One of the experiences on this particular trek was the fact that in meeting with boards and congregations, I met so very many new men and women that I hadn't met on my last contact with the congregation, giving obvious evidence of the growth of the congregation, not only the replacement of leadership, but new people brought into the church and into Christian faith who were now leading the congregation to replace some of the former leaders. It wasn't on this particular trip, but I think of men like the one where the pastor said that when he made the first call at the home, the man of the house swore at him, and in language which filled the air, almost literally blew, sent the pastor on his merry way. Today that man is a deacon in that congregation who goes out to call on others himself.
In American education, in politics, and in churchmanship, you face the issue of segregation and integration of the races. Dr. James H. Robinson of the Church of the Master in New York told us of one move toward better understanding.
Well, last Sunday, a week ago it was, we had an exchange with the Madison Avenue Presbyterian Church, which is located down in Midtown Manhattan, in what they call the fashionable area. I'm sure that church doesn't like that word, but that's the way the newspapers referred to it. 125 of their members came to our church, and 150 of our members went down to their church. We did this kind of an exchange interracially, which we thought is a much more effective and powerful way than just having an exchange of pastors, a Negro and white pastor changing.
Have you done this before?
Well, we've done not this before. We've done many other things, our choirs, our youth groups, and sometimes offices, but never that many people at one time.
What were the reactions of the people afterwards?
Very wholesome and very good. Our people learned a great deal about what was happening at the Madison Avenue Church, which, by the way, is much larger than our church, and they were so warmly and finely received that this meant a great deal, and I'm sure the people who came to us felt the same way. And by the way, now, we've gotten letters and telephone calls from many cities outside New York saying, would you please let us know how you did this and what the effects were? We'd like to try it.
That was in March. At the end of the year, there was word that the Negro congregation of Border Methodist Church in Minneapolis had accepted the invitation to join the congregation of previously all-white Hennepin Avenue Methodist Church. Monsignor John O'Grady of Washington, D.C., Secretary of the National Conference of Catholic Charities, told a state welfare conference last spring of a new dynamism in old-fashioned American neighborliness.
I see, for instance, a person who is a leader in the visiting of the agent. I see young people who are working with the aged folks and help them to maintain their gardens and their flower beds and their homes and helping them in running errands for them. I see what the aging are doing for themselves in those various blocks, in groups, by their own group organizations. Now, these are not organizations. This is just something that grows out of their Christian faith. That was their response to me. This kind of service is a product of our faith.
1956 was a major year for church conventions. Among them was the Methodist General Conference.
There were several important emphases. Probably the one that emerged as being of the most important was the emphasis on education in the local church. Evangelism received its share of emphasis, too. It was predicted that if Methodism keeps pace with the growth in population, it will have to receive 3 million new members in the next 4 years.
Exchange of persons among churches has been not only interracial, as mentioned 2 minutes ago, but also international. One of the 9 Americans who visited churches in the Soviet Union was Dr. Walter W. Van Kirk of the National Council of Churches.
I think that there are evidences of some recovery of religion in the Soviet Union, though I am still convinced that the churches are required to operate within such a narrow framework that they cannot fully or completely fulfill their mission. It is a part of the life of the church that our risen Lord shall be glorified in the sanctuary. It is also the duty and responsibility of the Christian churches, as we understand the business of the churches, to serve as the conscience of the state and to bring the leaders of secular society under the judgment of Almighty God. In this sense, there is no freedom of the churches in the Soviet Union.
Another convention, that of the Evangelical Lutheran Church, heard of an urgent situation facing America's churches.
We are going to need 100,000 new congregations in America in the next 25 years. That is not a dream. It's not something visionary. It's based on rather careful and conservative estimates of what is happening in America.
The ELC also voted to proceed with plans for union in 1960 with the American Lutheran Church and the United Evangelical Lutheran Church. The latter group took similar action after their convention. Still another Lutheran convention last summer faced the need for church expansion to keep pace with our growing nation.
The Missouri Synod has accepted a goal of establishing 1,350 new congregations in America during the next 10 years. This represents an increase of 350 over the number of new congregations actually organized during the previous 10-year period. To supply these new stations with just the basic facilities, it is estimated the Synod Church Extension Board will be asked to lend over $22 million.
1956 was a year also of political conventions, in which the spiritual foundations of our nation were often referred to and whose sessions were opened with prayer. A Philadelphia Baptist one day led the Democrats at Chicago with these words.
Eternal God, our Father, in the fulfillment of whose will only men and nations achieve their high destiny, we lay before thee this day in prayer our concern for this convention and invoke thy rich blessing upon it and implore thy guidance for it.
America's Congregational Christian Churches voted last summer to proceed with a merger in June of 1957, and the action of their partner in the union was reported to us by its president emeritus, Dr. Lewis Goebel.
The Evangelical Reformed Church at its General Synod here in Lancaster voted unanimously to participate in effecting the union next year.
Also moving closer to union in 1956 were the Presbyterian Church in the USA and the United Presbyterian Church. Most dramatic in the news of religion in the closing months of the year were the stories of East European churchmen being released from communist imprisonment and restored in various degrees to their offices. Most prominent were these. In Poland, Stefan Cardinal Wyszynski saw the light of freedom. In Hungary, Lutheran Bishop Lajos Ordas won legal restoration to his office. And at the height of the insurrection, Joseph Cardinal Minventi was liberated, but soon had to seek refuge in the U.S. legation in Budapest. The executive secretary of the Lutheran World Federation, Dr. Karol Lundquist, who had recently been in Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary, spoke of some factors making possible the more favorable pattern of church-state relationships in Eastern Europe.
The signal of the 20th Party Congress of de-Stalinization led to a great deal more freedom for our churches in Eastern Europe. That's fact number one. Number two, of course, is the whole scheme of development from the point of view of Russia and all the communist parties, that in this period there should be a form of coexistence, peace and goodwill, and a good front toward the West. And certainly the satellites also came or experienced this new policy on the part of Russia. Those two factors, plus the rise of nationalism in these satellite countries, expressed itself in the form of a new policy and strategy toward the church.
On the other side of the world, some imprisoned churchmen have been freed by communist China, but a few remain under arrest in spite of diplomatic promises that they'd be released. Returning from Australia, where he'd won another Olympic gold medal for a new record in pole vaulting, Reverend Bob Richards of the Church of the Brethren said that 85% of America's track and field team was openly religious. And he explained,
"There's more than just the body that goes into these great competitions. There's spiritual power. I don't know of any biblical verse that so beautifully portrays it as this one. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with the wings of the eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint."
These have been some of the ways in which the church has been at work during 1956, as reflected in the week-by-week reporting of this program. In essence, Christian work in 1956 was the same as it had been for nearly 2,000 years before, teaching the will of God and salvation through Christ, and serving mankind in the spirit of divine love. As we enter 1957, we'll find the same story again in new and different situations. It's all part of the continuing story of the church at work in our home communities, at work overseas, and at work in the minds and hearts of men and women. The Church at Work is transcribed for this station by the Lutheran Broadcasting Center of Minneapolis, a service of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. This is James V. Anderson speaking and wishing you 365 days of God's blessings in 1957. Listen again next week for more of the story of the Church at Work. What people do and what people think makes a difference not only to themselves but to many others. In your community and in every other, some of the most constructive work and thought originates in the church. We bring you now stories of the church at work. This is James Anderson speaking. The church at work is a transcribed report of what men and women and their church organizations are planning and accomplishing in their own communities and throughout the world. You'll also meet a young contractor from Oregon who's found a way to be both builder and foreign missionary. And we'll ask some questions of Major C.C. Briggs of the Salvation Army. We welcome today the audience of station WUOA at University Alabama, one of the country's leading educational stations. The Church at Work is now broadcast by 20 stations located in 12 states and Alaska. Workers on strike at four Republic Aviation plants in the Farmingdale, New York area are receiving food and money collected by the Protestant Episcopal Diocese of Long Island. Now that could be misunderstood unless you hear the rest of the story. The 11,600 machinists at the four plants walked off their jobs last February 19th after lengthy negotiations over wage increases and welfare benefits had reached an impasse. As soon as the strike began, Jack Healy, founder and chairman of the five-year-old Republic Interfaith Fellowship, sought help for his fellow strikers through Episcopal Bishop James P. D. Wolfe of Long Island. At the bishop's suggestion,
The Diocesan Commission on Labor and Management, headed by Canonry Edward Saunders, offered its services to mediate the strike. The union accepted the commission's offer, but the company rejected it. Thereupon, Roman Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish clergymen of the area joined with Canon Saunders in forming a new committee to end the strike. Once again, the union accepted, but the company never formally accepted the offer, although it did meet with the committee. When later federal mediation also failed to produce any settlement, the Episcopal Diocese turned its full effort to helping needy strikers and their families, regardless of their religious affiliation. Through its Department of Christian Social Relations, Episcopalians throughout Long Island were asked to help strikers living in their parishes and to send as much aid as possible for distribution among Republic strikers everywhere in the area. Meanwhile, Jack Healy, who has been spending his after work hours studying for the Episcopal priesthood, turned to the local Democratic and Republican party leaders for aid, pointing to the example set by the church, and he got it from them, too. Houston, Texas, an institute of religion to help develop the healing team, was dedicated in the city's Texas Medical Center. It was established back in 1954 at the request of the center's Council of Administrators, to train the medical personnel, pastors, and the ministerial students to become a working health team. With Dr. Dawson C. Bryan, the Institute's director, we are building for a long tomorrow. Courses at the Institute will be accepted for credit at 5 Protestant theological seminaries in Texas. Mennonites of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, have shipped 20 brown Swiss heifers to poverty-stricken farmers in northern Greece. The heifers will be part of an agricultural rehabilitation project being conducted at Paniitra, Greece, by Mennonite young men in the Fox services there. Fox services, or peace services, is a program of overseas rehabilitation for draft-age men, sponsored in 10 countries by the Mennonite Central Committee. The Greek farmers are learning from Fox men how to care for their previously unproductive soil, to preserve meats and vegetables, and to raise poultry. 33-year-old Donald Mortensen is a veteran of South Pacific service in World War II and a native of Boulder, Colorado, but in recent years has been a building contractor at Albany, Oregon. He's been a successful one, too. Don and his attractive wife, Marion, have two equally attractive children, a boy age 3 and a girl age 1. Last month, Mortensen sold his business and with the family headed for the large French-governed island of Madagascar, near the southeastern coast of Africa. There, Mortensen will be a missionary of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. But on the trip with family baggage went a power winch, an arc welding outfit, an electric generator, and other tools. Not the usual equipment of a missionary. Before sailing, we asked Don Mortensen what he expected to build in Madagascar.
He seemed to have plenty for me to do. Some of the projects I've heard about are a missionary home at Lebanon outside of Fort Dauphin, a missionary station, a dormitory classroom building for a normal school at Menin-Tenley, a doctor's residence, completion of hospital buildings, a library for a theological seminary, and possibly a rebuilding.
In the past, missionaries have usually had to manage construction of necessary facilities with whatever knowledge they had and with primitive native equipment. Builder missionary Mortensen is one of several specialists now on mission fields who help with Christian teaching themselves, but free ordained missionaries for more pastoral work, while technical work also is better done than before. The Mortensen family has left a comfortable home and a lucrative business to begin a strange life in a far land. We asked why.
While it was more or less lucrative, I still wasn't satisfied that I was doing the thing that God wanted me to do. And this opportunity came to go to the foreign mission field. And we, my wife and I, feel that that is the thing that God wants us to do.
That was Donald Mortensen, formerly of Boulder, Colorado, and Albany, Oregon, soon to be of Madagascar. We've reported previously on two visits of American churchmen to the Soviet Union. Last August, four U.S. Baptist leaders were in Russia and in March, 9 Protestant leaders made the journey. Now a Russian Baptist delegation is in the United States, and plans have been announced for a visit here by other Christian leaders from the Soviet Union. 5 Russian Baptist leaders have begun a 30-day tour of the United States. It is the first official Russian church delegation to visit the United States since 1906. The group came here at the invitation of this country's major Baptist body. All its members are officers of a Baptist body known as the All-Soviet Council of Evangelical Christians. Yakov Svidkov, president of the council and spokesman for the deputation, said that the purpose of the visit is to become further acquainted with your great land and your culture, and as representatives of the churches, to strengthen ties between Russian Baptists and Baptists and other denominations here. The delegation said they received no instructions from the Soviet government prior to their departure. A spokesman for the welcoming U.S. committee said the tour will include visits to churches, seminaries, schools, and other religious centers across the country. Alexander Karev, General Secretary of the All-Union Council of Evangelical Christians, described the evangelism technique being employed by Russian Baptists. He told more than 1,000 worshipers at Calvary Baptist Church in Washington, D.C., that personal evangelism has been the key to growth of the Baptist Church in the Soviet Union. He said, "Every Russian Baptist considers himself a missionary. In every one, we have a little Billy Graham. Not a big one, just a little one. We go to every street or alley and talk about Jesus Christ, person to person." Yakov Svidkov, who was mentioned before, said that Russian Baptists must memorize large portions of the Bible as part of their training. He said Soviet Baptists are grateful that it has been through the effort of the American Bible Society that we have the Bible available in Russian. Meanwhile, the National Council of Churches announced that in reciprocation of the visit by a widely representative group of U.S. churchmen, 9 Soviet churchmen will now be guests of the National Council in this country in June. Lutherans, Baptists, Armenian Orthodox, and Russian Orthodox are represented in the delegation scheduled to leave Moscow June 1st. They are to arrive in New York the next day and will visit New Haven, Philadelphia, Washington, and several places in Ohio. Plans call for a continuation of formal conversations begun with the American churchmen in Moscow and for a close view of the life and work of American churches in city, town, and village. At Portland, Indiana, the Indiana Congregational Christian Conference has adopted a resolution at its annual meeting calling upon religious and other interested groups to cooperate with it in putting an end to the state's marriage mills. It urged that they work towards securing legislation that would impose a mandatory 2-day waiting period between application for and issuance of marriage licenses. Saturday night moviegoers at Münster and Cuxhaven, 2 West German cities, have only to dial a number to get a moral evaluation of the picture that they plan to see. This new service is being provided by the Catholic Film League, which was organized by the German hierarchy in 1951. Similar to the Legion of Decency in the United States, the League now has nearly 2 million members in Germany. The week of May 20th to 27th has been marked nationally as Salvation Army Week. With us on the Church at Work today is Major C.C. Briggs, who has been commissioned in the Salvation Army for 24 of his 49 years.